This podcast is a production of KCRW and KCRW.com Santa Monica. If you enjoy this program, check out KCRW.com for more than 20 additional programs that you can podcast.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that. But prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, what does a producer do? We talked to two producers turned studio executives about what they did and what they do now. Plus, a chat with Hollywood's man in Washington, Motion Picture Association CEO Dan Glickman. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan, the show that promises to never go on strike. This is The Business from NPR. There is only one real Hollywood story right now, and that is the writer's strike. If you see a bunch of scraggly-looking guys in baseball caps walking around in circles on the sidewalk today, they may be writers. Or it may be the homeless. They're sometimes hard to tell apart. Yes, despite last-ditch talks and even federal mediation, the writers walked away from the bargaining table last night and started walking the picket line this morning. Since negotiations started over the summer, the major sticking points have been twofold. One, the writers want to be paid more money from DVD sales and rentals, and two, they want to be paid for work that is distributed on the web and even through other means yet to be imagined. Who can really blame them? The writers got burned in 1985 when they made a terribly short-sighted deal on how to be paid for home video, and it appears, as the song goes, they won't get fooled again. The screenwriters are now saying they're willing to let the past be the past, and they've given up the idea of getting more on DVD. But they won't let the past be the future, and digital remains the point of implacability. So, what does all this mean for Hollywood, and of course us, the TV-watching and movie-going public? Well, the shows with the shortest production cycles, like talk shows, will be the first and hardest hit. In the unlikely event that late-night chat shows continue to produce new programs, be prepared to see Jay Leno singing a medley of show tunes in place of his usual monologue. Come to think of it, that might be an improvement. If the late-night talk shows stop production, the networks will most likely air repeats. Daytime soaps are said to have enough shows, scripts, and story arcs to last them through the end of the year. Though, if the strike lasts longer than that, you might see Luke and Laura get married again. And again. Current scripted series will continue to crank out episodes as long as they have workable scripts. Things are likely to get complicated, though, because many TV producers are also TV writers, and they may want to show solidarity with their union. Tina Fey, for instance, is caught between 30 Rock and a Hard Place, but is said to be walking the picket line even as we speak. If the strike doesn't end quickly, next year's TV season will be really thrashed, as pilots that aren't really ready for primetime are rushed into production, and many more fledgling shows are dumped. The TV networks are said to be preparing replacement programs for some of the new and current shows that were supposed to be on air. There's talk of importing foreign shows like the original British version of The Office, making new news magazines the way they did during the last writer's strike, or producing new reality shows. Those reality shows, ironically enough, could become staffed by striking writers. If any of the replacement shows are hits, by the way, expect to see them stay on the air even after a strike ends. The flow of movies through 2008 will probably not be much affected. In fact, Variety reports that at least 50 films are said to be ready for production in the coming months. Unless, of course, the Teamsters, remember those guys who drive the trucks, make good on their offer to honor the writers' picket line. In which case, goodbye summer 2009 blockbusters. Oddly enough, it is movie marketing that will be affected more than the movies themselves. As TV audiences get tired of reruns of Conan, soaps written by receptionists, dramas imported from Bangalore, and bad reality shows like MILF Island, the studio's main avenue to market films will become less and less traveled. Curiously, for those same reasons, a strike that is mostly about the web may be a huge boon to the web and to another device loathed by advertisers. Over the course of a protracted strike, TiVo and its clones will become not a luxury, but a lifeline. All of this, of course, is predicated on a protracted strike. So, let's all pray for a quick and equitable end to this little squabble, and we can all get back to laying on our sofas, in our underwear, watching TV. Amen. A book called The Independent Film Producer's Survival Guide tells the story of a producer of the 1983 film The Cotton Club, who sued for co-producer credit. She argued that the public would be misled if the film was released without her being listed properly. The distributor's lawyers argued, and the federal court agreed, that the public would not be misled, since no one knows what a producer does anyway. There's no more important or mysterious job in Hollywood than that of producer. Even people who do know what a producer is don't necessarily know exactly what you mean if you simply say, "I'm a producer." Do you work in music, TV, film, the web? Are you hands-on? Are you the money? A creative type? When it comes to film in particular, producers generally fall into one of those three categories. There are the practical folks who make sure that people and things are where they're supposed to be when they're supposed to be there. They might be called line producers or coordinating producers. There are studio executives, outside money men, or stars with a vanity credit who get the title of executive producer. And then there are the producers with a capital P, the people who you usually think of when someone says producer. You know, Scott Rudin, Brian Grazer, Jerry Bruckheimer, Joel Silver. Of course, most producers are not that well known or that well compensated, but they all do pretty much the same thing. They are the traffic cops at the intersection of art and commerce, planted firmly between the creative and business sides of the enterprise, and beholden to both. These producers may conjure a project out of thin air, starting by buying a book or an idea, hiring the writer and director, and finding the money to make it all happen. Or they may help a director realize their creative vision. They may have a deal with a studio and a bungalow on the lot, or they may be independents who make films completely outside the system. Regardless, the producer allocates the money, hires staff, is involved in casting and making deals. Some work closely with the director on creative decisions. You'll find the more hands-on producers regularly sitting on set. If the producers have done their jobs well, they are the ones that go up on stage to accept the Best Picture Oscar. Because, at least on paper, a movie would not have happened, at least not the way it happened, without them. Today we're going to talk with two producers who have taken new jobs as studio suits. A comparison of the two roles reveals a lot about what it means to be a producer. Robert Kessel was partner and production head at indie outfit Heart Sharp Entertainment, making such films as Evening, The Night Listener, and Proof. Sean first ran his production company, First Films, with his brother Brian. They made films like The Cooler, The Matador, and The Woods. Both Robert and Sean have been every kind of producer, but they're now executive vice presidents of production and acquisitions at Overture Films, a new studio created recently by Liberty Media. Adam's based on the East Coast, Sean's on the West. They're both with us in studio today. Sean first, Robert Kessel, welcome to the business.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
I'm going to start with Sean. What were you doing right before you took this new job?
I was actually in the middle of finishing up a movie that we were shooting in New York City called The Girl in the Park. It was the last movie First Films produced, an independent movie made without any distribution in place. We put it together the same way that we put together every other movie, which is out begging with a hat in hand.
So Robert, same question for you. I mean, what were you doing just before you?
Actually, funny enough, we were in production on a film actually with Focus Features called Evening. I was heading up production on a company called Heart Sharp Entertainment, which was a boutique New York-based production company.
So you're both living pretty hand-to-mouth as producers trying to put everything together, bubblegum and tape and string and that sort of thing. How does the job change now for you? Sean, let me start with you. I mean, what's different now?
Well, what's different is, we are actually responsible for putting together a pretty substantial slate of movies, 8 to 12 movies a year, ultimately, is what the goal is for the company. And I would say, generally speaking, we function more as portfolio managers, to just use a reference, as opposed to, the type of hands-on producers that we were at First Films, and I know that Robert was at Heart Sharp.
Robert, how many movies did you used to make a year? You were at Heart Sharp.
We averaged about a film a year.
Mm-hmm. And was that true for you too?
Yeah, I would say about a film a year.
And this is obviously a hell of a lot more. All right, so dumb but elemental and important question. Are you still producers, Robert Kessel?
No, I would not say I'm a producer anymore. I would say that I can speak the producer lingo because, like, Sean used to budgets, used to being on set. But I think the important thing that we're trying to do is empower the producers we're working with. And I think actually when we first started at the company, one of the things that I actively did, because I'm based in New York, is actually hold meetings with all the New York-based producers that were used to be my colleagues and now were people that I could work with in a different way. And I think knowing who knows how to actually produce a movie and make films was sort of important to find not just the material but also people that could actually then go off and produce. So
You've also got the checkbook.
We have the checkbook. We're buyers, not sellers anymore, which is the hugest transition. Although at HeartSharp, we had a small equity fund, so I was used to kind of being both the studio on one level because we'd finance our films and being the producer. So you'd sort of fight with yourself at times too.
Sean, do you think of yourself still as a producer?
I mean, technically, I'm not. I feel like I have transitioned to becoming a facilitator of movies. And, you know, in truth, that is what a producer does. But it's also a position where I'm servicing a larger goal, which is the goals of Overture.
You look a little wistful when I asked you that question, like you were letting go of something in your head for the first time.
Yeah, well, look, it's a job that I embraced with every fiber in my body, and I loved it. And I respect producers for what they do because it's not an easy job. And the small percentage of time that you're successful at that job is one of the most gratifying things. So I have a lot of respect for producers.
You love having the checkbook, don't you?
Wow. I mean, it is really a different position for us to be in. You know, on one hand, as an independent producer, you're able to sort of be a little bit more shifty and get involved in projects for, if not nothing, very close to nothing, based on your passion and your track record and your ability to deliver. And
you say shifty like it's a good thing.
Well, I mean, you show me a producer that doesn't have that on their resume. it's a job that requires a lot of thinking outside the box, being a movie producer. And being a studio executive, you know, having the power of the checkbook, you know, is, you know, it's not something certainly coming from the other side of the fence that you want to abuse. Having, you know, heard the word no several times as a movie producer, you know, you want to be very delicate and you want to be very thoughtful in the way that you deal with the producers that you deal with. You want them to come back.
I think it's less about, for me, about the checkbook as much as looking at it as a larger canvas now for us. Because I think a lot of times when you used to read material as an independent producer, certainly the kind of movies we were making, you would always very much focus on things that you could scrap together a couple $1 million to make. And, you know, for us, we're doing films up to $30 million. So the canvas of the kinds of material that you're reading and can actually take seriously, the types of filmmakers maybe you can now be in business with, has expanded beyond sort of, for me, it used to be a lot of times first-time filmmakers, second-time filmmakers begging for $5,000 options on books that we would develop. And now you're able to kind of think a little bit bigger.
Just from having heard you both articulate what it is you used to do and what you do now, it seems like such a vastly different job that it sort of begs the question, why'd they hire you? And I say that with affection, but really, why? I mean, what were they buying when they got you, Robert? Were they buying, you know, sort of creative vision or business acumen or?
I think for me, because I was New York based, they were looking for good relationships within the New York and the UK film community, someone that knew how to make a movie and do it at a price, and you know, I think had relatively good creative instincts, although if anything, the knock against me was, you know, is my taste too precious? You know, have I made too much kind of arty-farty specialized films? You know, and would I be able to step up and do some kind of more commercial stuff?
Sean, what were they getting? Explain the package.
They wanted people who were entrepreneurial, people that had an ongoing business. So if you look at both Robert and I, it was pretty clear to Danny that, you know, when he did his research and I know that they met several people for the job, that we had reputations of following through, of doing what we said we were going to do and doing it in an elegant way.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Robert Kessel and Sean First. Both were successful indie producers who recently took jobs as production executives at the new studio, Overture Films. How did you learn to be a producer, Robert? I mean, your background was
acquisitions,
sort of, yeah. Acquisitions, right?
You go to set and you just learn. I don't think there really is a training course. I mean, I know that there is the Peter Stark program, and I'm sure had I learned on a more academic level, maybe I would have been a better producer. But some of it is just showing up. And to be honest, real people skills, I think, is most first and foremost.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Sean? Did you follow the same path?
I mean, also, I pretty much threw myself into it. You know, I was a theater and business double major in college, and I had interned and worked at a very low level at a few production companies, and kind of just discovered that this was really well suited to my education and my passions. And
what were you doing there then as an intern? I mean, just sort of,
you know, reading scripts and
getting coffee
and you know, going on set and lugging cable if I had to. I mean, you know, I also started in New York at an independent production company, and, you know, as scrappy as independent production companies are here, they're even scrappier in New York. And, you know, I got a perspective on what it was to be a producer from sort of the grunt level, and I think that that was invaluable because it allowed me to sort of step into a lot of different positions wherever I was needed to help plug a hole.
Robert, are you more of a creative guy or more of a finance guy?
That's a good question. At Hartsharp, I had to do both because we were, even though we had an outside attorney, we did our own kind of deals and stuff like that. And now at Overture, because it's a bigger company, the blessing is also a curse in that it's, you know, your role focuses much more on the creative side because you have a business affairs department. You know, we didn't have at Hartsharp, it was, you know, six people. At Overture, it's a full-fledged 60-person company. So
just to be clear, the business affairs guys are the ones who look over every contract say, what? Heroin is not a line item.
That's right. So, you know, having other people, the company, take over on the business side, I would say, has moved me purely into the creative realm, which is fine because that's actually, to be honest, the more fun part of it all.
Mm-hmm. Sean?
Although I wouldn't undervalue the experience that both Robert and I bring to the table with regard to, you know, being able to see the whole picture, the big picture. When we evaluate a movie, we are evaluating it based on all of its merits, not just whether or not we like the story or whether or not we like the director attached to it, but does this movie have international value? Is there a way to structure this movie where we can bring a partner in and defray some of our risk on the movie? Does that make sense for this particular movie? Does this movie play best internationally? Does it play best domestically? And those are all things that we had to know and ask ourselves when we made our own movies, because we had to know how to structure the deals and who the likely partners would be. And I think that certainly plays into a company like Overture, where we are really versatile in terms of the deal making we do, and we look at all different kinds of deals. We don't just fully finance pictures, and we don't just acquire movies. We are looking at it from all different perspectives, and we're going to do the deal that best suits the project and ultimately best suits Overture.
What did you love about producing that you can't do anymore, Sean?
I mean, there's an intimacy with the process. It's like having a child, as cliche as that sounds. You know, you rear it out of its smallest and, you know, most simple form, which is the idea, and take it all the way through to sitting on a mix stage with a director and, you know, deciding whether or not that sound effect is going to make a difference in the scene, or whether or not that visual effect is, you know, going to change the way you look at a character or you look at an event. And, you know, that's the intimacy of those moments.
Robert, let me ask you, I mean, what did you love about the job you don't get to do anymore now that you're
it's
not?
It's funny because what I think I loved about the job is not dissimilar from what Sean said, although it's also what I'm actually very happy to give up, which is, as Sean said, the intimacy, the day-to-day management of a production is both incredibly satisfying and obviously incredibly tiring. I mean, being there for first shot and the end of the day wrap and staying up till 4 a.m. and stuff like that were things that you develop relationships that obviously you don't have when you become the suit or the studio executive and you visit a set. And, you know, you have that relationship probably with the director and the producer, but in terms of the actors, the crew, the camaraderie that goes on a set, you're not part of that in the same way that you are when you produce it. So I'll miss that aspect of it on one level. On the other hand, the other side of it is you get to be involved with more projects. You get to have a bird's eye view and sort of do the work, to be honest, that I enjoyed most, which was watching the whole thing come together as opposed to being completely obsessed whether or not we got that one, that one pickup shot that we needed, or that we were burning too much film, or all the things that you're pulling your hair out as a producer on is not the job of a studio executive. So probably, you know, the intimacy of the production is something that you have to give up, but that's okay. you get to date more projects this way.
You're a swinger.
I'm a swinger now. That's right. That's exactly right.
Sean First and Robert Kessel are executive vice presidents of production and acquisitions for the newly christened Overture Films. Robert, based in New York, and Sean in Los Angeles. They joined us both in our Santa Monica studio. Robert, Sean, thanks for being on The Business.
Thanks a lot.
Overture's first release is the broad comedy Mad Money with Diane Keaton, Katie Holmes, and Queen Latifah, due out in January. The Visitor, a dramedy with a more indie feel, comes out in April. After a short break, a chat with Hollywood's Man in Washington. You're listening to The Business from NPR. You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. When we say MPAA, you think ratings. And yes, it is the MPAA's ratings board which assigns those cute little letter grades to every movie. But the Motion Picture Association of America is first and foremost a trade group made up of the big studios, Hollywood's voice in Washington, so to speak. In fact, the rating system was really a cunning political move, an attempt at self-legislating the industry before Congress got into the ugly censorship business. The MPAA has 45 staffers on the Hill whose primary job it is to represent the agenda of the film business in the corridors of power. So, it's no surprise that when Jack Valenti stepped down as head of the MPAA a few years ago, he was replaced by a consummate Beltway insider. Dan Glickman was a Secretary of Agriculture under Bill Clinton and a five-term Democratic congressman from Kansas. He's here to give us the Hollywood Capitol Hill update. Dan Glickman, welcome to The Business.
Thank you very much for having me.
We had you on the show in February before your Business of Show Business symposium unfolded in all its grandeur and splendor. How'd it go?
It was terrific. We had an opportunity to bring dozens and dozens of members of Congress, people in the government, together with some folks from the entertainment community. Will Smith came and spoke. We had Clint Eastwood there. We had most of the CEOs from the member companies of the Motion Picture Association there. They participated in panels. We're mostly talking about the economic impact of this business, jobs produced in the U.S. and around the world, and the GNP impact. And I thought it was quite productive, actually.
So what were the results you were looking for, and what did you get?
I think the main result is highlighted the level of consciousness about the economic impact of the film industry. Often when we go to Capitol Hill or we talk to policymakers, it's about issues like piracy, let's say, or like First Amendment or trade or, you know, content protection. But we wanted to make sure that there was a context for all these issues so that people know that this is an industry that employs well over a million people in the United States. It's the only industry that has a positive balance of payments surplus with every single country in the world we do business with. Not agriculture, not aviation, but film and television. And the impact on our GNP is significant. Oftentimes, people in politics see the entertainment community and film particularly as a bunch of very rich movie stars who sometimes behave badly. Not always, but sometimes. What we wanted to show is that this is a big business that employs hundreds of thousands of people in every state in the country. In fact, film and television production is growing nationwide, and that therefore it had an economic impact on the country, and therefore their decisions ought to be viewed in that context. Plus, the second thing we were trying to show is this is a winner of a business. I mean, this is a business that's growing, that's productive, it's positive economically to the country. And so the government ought to be doing whatever it can to promote its winners, and that was one of the things.
The movie business has been around like 100 years. TV's been around like, you know, 50 plus. Why is it so hard to get that message through the rather thick skull of Congress?
Well, of course, I can't acknowledge that there are thick skulls there since I was one. You know, I think that's always probably been that thing that, you know, the TV set is ubiquitous. Whatever comes in there is there. And we got to do a better job in our industry of showing how difficult it is to actually make and create this product, but also how it affects people's lives in terms of jobs and just a continuing obligation that we have to do.
But Congress has kind of historically separated, or at least had to appear to separate, you know, the business from business. It's often used as like a boogeyman. What do you do to change Hollywood's image?
People love the movies. They may not like all the movie makers, but they love the movies. Recently, I had a lunch with a conservative newspaper columnist. He writes a column and nationally syndicated, and he's talking about all the movies that he loves and how what impact they have. And, you know, and he's one of the guys that sometimes rails against, you know, the industry as a whole. This is always a challenge when some people in the business behave badly, particularly some people in the talent, or we find, you know, this industry is one that's historically probably more of the talent have been on the left of the political equation over the years, and we become a convenient whipping boy for people on the other side. By the way, it's bipartisan, too. We're often a whipping boy by Democrats as much as Republicans. But underlying all of this stuff is that people still love entertainment. They love film. And I'm going to give you a little statistic to prove a point. Right now, you know, America's fighting a war overseas, and America and American policy is not the most popular in the world right now. Notwithstanding the unpopularity in some quarters of about American foreign policy, the gross theatrical revenues of our movies overseas is growing at the same rate it's growing inside the United States. That is that we have not seen any harm or anybody targeting the sale of American film and television overseas based on foreign policy by congressional or political leaders.
What's at the top of your to-do list right now? I mean, what is the burning issue right now for you?
Well, I'd say that the number one item has to do with how we protect our content, our movies and television shows and related material from being stolen, lifted, used without consent or without compensation. It's not just the simple thing of finding fake DVDs on the streets anymore. It's the use of modern technology to transfer information almost instantaneously and in a ubiquitous way on the internet. That's probably the top issue that we deal with.
What are you working on in Congress right now that has to happen for things to...
Well, I'd say
to go well for Dan Glickman.
Okay, in addition to the general always working on content protection, I'd say two things. Number one, constantly fighting censorship, whether it's before the famous Federal Communications Commission that, at least in modern years, has wanted to come in and regulate indecency or violence on broadcast television and in radio. And those are issues that we monitor, and generally we do our best to fight any attempts on censoring product that takes place, not only in Congress, but in the states as well. The second thing is dealing with international trade. 60% of film is sold outside the United States. If it weren't for the international market, our companies would be a shell of themselves. And so we fight international trade issues, efforts to restrict the importation of our products, whether they're in China, which is a big particular problem for us, or wherever in the world that exists.
Is there any piece of legislation that is percolating right now that you can talk about?
The one thing that I would talk about, there is a piece of legislation which would significantly increase enforcement tools by the United States government to deal with copyright infringement and counterfeiting, including things like increasing customs enforcement of counterfeit items. We've developed actually a coalition with the manufacturing world, with the car manufacturers, airplane manufacturers, pharmaceutical manufacturers, to deal with this enormous problem of counterfeiting and piracy. When people think of piracy, they always use the DVD as kind of the poster boy of piracy.
But software, drugs.
Software, drugs, you know, cars, airplanes, I mean, you name it. And so we've developed a coalition to try to deal with customs enforcement, where a lot of the stuff comes in much more aggressively than we have before. Hopefully, we're going to get that done legislatively in the next several months.
What about the courts? Is there anything pending right now that you're watching with keen interest?
There are a lot of issues involving the courts. Of course, we won a victory 2 years ago in the case of MGM versus Grokster. We won a unanimous Supreme Court decision, which helps us because what that case basically said is if you had like a peer-to-peer service where they encouraged or facilitated copyright infringement, they could be liable, as well as those that were actually doing the formal infringement could be liable.
Well, Dan Glickman, that's all the time we have, but it was a real pleasure having you
on the program. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Come back anytime.
Go to the movies, whatever you do.
Dan Glickman is Hollywood's man in Washington. He's the chairman and CEO of the Motion Picture Association of America. Dan, thanks for being on The Business.
Glad to be here.
And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.